I'm Bud Ward. I edit the Yale Forum on Climate Change and Media. Covers how the media address climate change issues. And I'm very pleased to partner with my colleague in crime, Sunshine Menezes, who you'll hear from in a moment, the executive director of the Metcalf Institute. And Sunshine and I together brought a dozen or so business journalists, finance journalists to SEJ this year to help them, to basically to introduce them to SEJ, which is a great organization, as you all know. I think I've been to 17 of their 19 conferences. And so they're in the audience, and we want them to learn a little bit about SEJ, what it has to offer. And we also basically are trying to move climate change coverage beyond the environment and science desks, to the extent there are still desks at individual news organizations, that get it out into other issues where it's so important. I've got to tell you, I am really excited to hear Jim Hamilton. Jim is at Duke University, and Jim is the author of a book. I thought I had a pretty good sense of what was going on in journalism, in modern journalism across the country all along. I followed fairly closely, and then I read Jim's book, and it really opened up my understanding in very exciting ways, and I hope he'll be able to do that in part for you today. Jim Hamilton is the author. He's the professor, let me get this right, the Charles S. Sidnor Professor of Public Policy Studies, Professor of Political Science and Economics at Duke. His 2004 book, All the News That's Fit to Sell, How the Market Transforms Information into News, was published by Princeton University Press, won the Frank Luther Mott Award. Jim is an expert in computational journalism, and as if this all didn't make him just right down our alley, he's also worked extensively in environmental and natural resources issues. So I'm really excited to introduce you to Jay Hamilton and to JT Hamilton, Jim, and have him talk with you. I also want to do one further introduction, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague Sunshine. Roger Dower at the end of the table is a longtime personal friend of mine. Roger and I worked together in the late 70s in Washington, D.C. And some of you will recognize this. Roger is an economist by training. I was the journalist in the organization, and Roger was the one who was always pressing me to show a good business plan for quality journalism, which I so much appreciated
and ignored.
but Roger is a natural resources economist. Roger is now the president of the Johnson Foundation in Racine, Wisconsin. He's worked for the Congressional Budget Office. He headed the World Resource Institute's Climate, Energy, and Pollution Program. He was the president of the U.S. Forest Stewardship Council. He was the president of E-Energy Solve Corporation. And I think Roger's foundation is helping host, am I correct on this, the event tomorrow evening.
We're proud to be.
Proud to be running helping the event tomorrow evening. So you'll hear from Roger after Jay makes his remarks. With that, let me introduce you to Sunshine, who I hope you already know.
Thanks, Bud. I am here just to kind of wrap up our introductions. And we're going to start by having Jay Hamilton give kind of an overview of this issue and then have Roger and Sharon Dunwoody follow up kind of as respondents. And then we'll open this up to questions from you all. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Sharon Dunwoody formally. She is the Bascom Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication here in town at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she teaches courses on science communication, writing, research, communication, and public opinion, introductory mass communication. She's also, as of relatively recently, I understand, the Associate Dean for Social Studies in the Graduate School at Wisconsin's program. She studies the public understanding of science, including news-gathering behaviors of science and environmental journalists, the nature of messages, the effects of messages on audience, all very relevant issues for the topic at hand. She's also former head of the section on general interest in science and technology at the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, past president of the Midwest Association for Public Opinion Research, past president of the Association for Education in Journalism and Mass Communication, and she currently serves on the Committee on Public Understanding of Science and Technology for AAAS. I also, before I hand this over, just want to be sure that you've all noticed that there are a few copies, at least, of a green book on your tables. That is a publication that Bud wrote and was published by Metcalf Institute just last year about communicating on climate change, and you'll also find copies of that outside of the room, as well as copies of the new NOAA publication about global climate change impacts or climate change impacts in the United States that was referenced by Dr. Luchenko earlier this morning. And with that, I welcome Jay Hamilton.
Thank you very much. It's slightly intimidating to talk to a group that I don't have grading power over, but I'm going to give it a shot. So the book that I wrote, All the News That's Fit to Sell, was meant to try to answer the question, how far can economics get you in explaining the state of public affairs coverage? And before I talk about climate change coverage, the economics of climate change coverage, I want to talk about, in general, the types of news markets that exist in the U.S. today. That's going to be a bit of a downer. And then I'm going to, at the end of the talk, talk about different ways that you could stimulate more coverage of public affairs, more coverage of climate change issues. And hopefully that'll be a hopeful note until we get to the discussion. So if you think about the markets for news, people have four different information demands: producer, consumer, entertainment, and voter. Producer, that's information that helps you do your job. So if you're actually working for a power company or working as a lobbyist or working as an environmental activist, reading about climate change gives you information that helps you do your job. Consumer, that's information that helps you get a better purchase price or a better product. So if last week I was actually living up to a stereotype and looking for a used Prius. So what I did was I went on Edmunds.com, I went on AutoTrader, I spent a lot of time getting information, and I'd like to believe that it helped me get a better product. Entertainment, that's just information that's fun for you to know. For some people, it could be watching Mad Men. For other people, it could be watching C-SPAN, and you know who you are. And the fourth type of information demand is voter or civics information. That's a different type of market for the following reason. The first three markets work pretty well because if you don't get the information, you don't get the benefit. If you think about the calculus that goes into being an informed voter, however, the probability that your vote is going to matter, say in a presidential election, the probability that your actual vote is going to determine who the president is, unless you're Justice Scalia, that's a very tiny probability. And so what that means is that even if you care a great deal about a particular issue, and even if more information would help you, the statistical probability that you're going to have an impact on politics means that you remain rationally ignorant about the details of politics. That's a phrase Anthony Downs made famous 40 years ago. It's not a very popular phrase. It goes against Jeffersonian notions of an informed democracy. But if you think about the gap between what people need to know as citizens and what they want to know as consumers, the reason why there is often not a high express demand for issues like climate change coverage or public affairs coverage is because from a rational investment standpoint, if I spent 3 days trying to learn more about the Obama health care coverage, I would not get a better Obama health care plan as an individual. That decision to remain rationally ignorant explains why there is not often high express demand. Now, many of you have made your living writing about public affairs, so as an economist, I have to deal with the fact that you are real. So I have to figure out what was the demand that you were satisfying. And I think of it as the three Ds: duty, diversion, and drama. Some people do believe that they have a duty to vote. I'm actually one of them. And so they actually read because they feel they have a duty to become informed. But what they're doing is they're not investing to make a better collective decision. It's more the consumption of an identity. I'm a citizen, I have this duty, or I'm a member of a particular party, and I want to become informed about my team. So some folks believe they have this duty. For some people, the details of politics or the details of climate change are actually diverting. So again, for them, C-SPAN is like ESPN. It's just interesting to know that information. And there is a subset of those. They watch the Lair NewsHour, and there aren't that many of them. But there are a large number in this room. So there are a subset of people for who that information is just interesting. And then drama. Maybe I can't tell you about the policies of a particular candidate, but I can tell you whether he or she was involved in a scandal. Or the horse race, I can tell you who's ahead or who's behind. Or corruption, I can tell you about the link between money and politics. That's bringing human interest, that's bringing the entertainment demand back into policy coverage. But if you think about what climate change coverage looks like, producer demand, that's the activist or utility. Consumer demand, I want to get a car that has a lower impact on the environment, so I'm going to study up on it. Entertainment demand, maybe I'm going to watch Ed Begley Jr. On a cable channel or something that's entertaining. And then voter information, things that might help me make a better voting decision relating to climate change. In the past, there it was relatively easy or more easier to do well and do good at the same time. And in fact, media companies were once owned by, we'll call them people, okay? They were families or individuals. And what they were willing to do was, for those people, they were willing to trade off some profits for the notion that they were contributing to their community, that they were doing the right thing. And as the owners, they had the right to do that. If you think about today's world of publicly traded stock companies with a fiduciary responsibility to maximize profit, it's harder to say, this may not be proxy maximizing, but we need to do this type of coverage. And in a world of the internet where Craigslist has taken your classified and Auto Trader in Edmonds is where I go rather than the other ads, it's harder and harder to do well and do good at the same time. So climate change is part of a broader problem. Covering climate change is part of a broader problem of covering public affairs. There are particular challenges that you all face when you write about climate change. Number one, it's international. And in a world where many metropolitan dailies are focusing on local or hyperlocal, it's even harder to do international, and that's evidenced by the closing of foreign bureaus, although there are other things that are hopeful, like Global Post and other networks. But we'll talk a little bit about that later. But number one, it's international. That's a hard sell. Number two, sense-making in this area entails a high fixed cost. So what that means is that you need to make some investment as a reader or as a journalist to understand what's going on. And that high fixed cost may deter anybody from in making the investment to understand what's going on, so that if you're telling them a narrative and you give them only a snapshot and they don't have the background, that also means that they're not going to be interested in it. Number three, it's in a world of probabilities and uncertainties. And if you don't have the background necessarily to make extensive judgments about what's going on, probability and uncertainty world means sometimes, on the one hand, on the other hand, reporting. And that also has been something that academics have studied with the climate change coverage. And then the fourth problem is that the set of things that people need to believe about climate change to get them interested are so depressing that they end up not wanting to read more. And this is something that people who are working on climate change are very aware of when you talk about how you frame this issue. But so climate change is part of the public affairs coverage problem. There are particular problems with covering climate change in the market, but how might you get more or better climate change coverage? What I want to talk about briefly are four different partial solutions, and they are number one, nonprofit ownership or nonprofit subsidies for the creation of news. Number two, an area, a new field called computational journalism. Number three, debate about behavioral advertising and targeting. And number four, the stimulation of more partisan information. So just briefly, those four things. Number one, nonprofit provision or nonprofit subsidies for the creation of information. That is in part what paid my ticket here today. And I think if you think about the Metcalf Institute or the Yale Forum, those are examples of nonprofits saying, we want to change the set of issues that people are thinking about, so we're going to subsidize that. And I view this as a spectrum. And when I say I, at Duke, at the DeWitt Wallace Center where I work, in May we had a conference on nonprofit media, And if you Google Duke Nonprofit Media Conference, you can see the reports that were done. But what we found is that there's essentially a spectrum. You could have nonprofit ownership of the outlet. You know, we have a history of that with NPR, but we also, with public affairs coverage, have new things sprouting up, local public affairs coverage like MNPO's Voice of San Diego, St. Louis Beacon. I know some of those people are in the room today. And on the environmental side, you see things like Yale 360 or even Duke University. One of our most recent hires at the Nicholas Institute at Duke was Eric Rosten, who used to work for Time Magazine, then wrote a book about the carbon age, and now he's a blogger paid by Duke University to write a 1,000-word post every Thursday afternoon called The Climate Post, which explains the policy debate. That's an example that you'll see more of nonprofits saying, we're going to provide you with information. So there's nonprofit ownership of an outlet. There's a new thing called the L3C, Low Profit Limited Liability Corporation. That would essentially have different types of owners in a media outlet. You could have foundations get program-related investment credit for investing and demanding a lower rate of return. That's something that is a bit of a unicorn right now. There is not, to my knowledge, media L3C, but people are talking about it. I know there's somebody at the conference here who's even planning on doing one. So that's something to watch in the future. You could have a standalone commercial media outlet with a separate fund for doing the non-profitable or unprofitable stuff. The Huffington Post has just announced this year that they're going to have a non-profit investigative arm. The same thing is going on in San Diego with the paper there. You can also have the subsidies for the creation of information still within the commercial outlet. So you could have the William Penn Foundation, which is basically paying for a reporter at a Philadelphia newspaper to write about education. Or in the climate world, you have the Metcalf Institute having fellows writing and producing stories at commercial outlets. So the way to think about that is maybe the nonprofit owns the outlet, maybe there's this hybrid, the L3C, maybe you have the commercial outlet and the nonprofit related to each other, or maybe the nonprofit says, we're going to subsidize a set of stories, a beat, reporters. And you see all of that going on in local public affairs coverage. You see it going on in health coverage. Most famously, the Kaiser Foundation now has its own news information system where they have hired reporters, and the reporters are writing articles about the healthcare debate. And you see it clearly in the environmental area. So if the market is not generating optimal coverage of an issue of public affairs, and we would predict that it wouldn't because public affairs coverage has positive spillovers or positive externalities, then maybe the nonprofit incentive would do it. Number two of the four things, computational journalism. Computational journalism is the combination of algorithms, data, and knowledge from social science as a way to lower the cost of accountability or watchdog coverage. If you look at the winner of the Grantham Prize this year, the USA Today articles that were done, that to me is an example of what computational journalism could be like today, where you essentially take information from the EPA, talk to academics about how you could model the exposures, and then you use computation to tell a story about the exposure of children to air pollution at schools. If you think about how that might work, how computational journalism would work and how it's different from CAR, right now it would be great if there were an open source suite of reporting tools that you as journalists could take a stack of 100 documents, run it through a scanner, search the text, and then have something come back and say, these are associations that we're surprised about, and here's an automatically generated timeline of the events in that story. Now, that sounds sort of fanciful, but it's being done today, but it's being done in Homeland Security. And so the ironic thing is, I became a director of a center at Duke in August, and there was a deadline in September for an NSF competition to create science centers. Science centers in the NSF world are large things that destroy things, like, you know, big machines that smash atoms. But I put in a proposal to the NSF to have a center for computational journalism, because I wanted to see how they would react to that proposal. And the responses were bimodal. One set of people said, this will never happen. It's too hard to do public interest data mining. And the other set of scientists said, we already do all these tools in Homeland Security. And they didn't see the irony that it's the government has great software to monitor millions of decisions that we make, but they hasn't funded accountability software or computational journalism that I could envision. So at Duke, we have the first night chair in computational journalism, Sarah Cohen, who was previously at the Washington Post. And that's a field that we're trying to stimulate. Third is behavioral advertising. That's a market-oriented solution to getting more support for your work, but it's going to be controversial. If you look at the Federal Trade Commission, they're holding hearings in December. Part of the building is very concerned about privacy on the Internet, and they would like to see a reduction in the use of what Yahoo, Google, and other people know about what you do on the web to target you with ads. Another part, however, of the building is beginning to see that, for instance, with the Yahoo News Consortium, I live in the Raleigh-Durham market, if I go on the News and Observer site, Yahoo can tell the News and Observer that I was searching for a used Prius on Yahoo, and the ad that I see when I'm reading about the city council is dependent on what I've done on the Internet before. That's going to be very controversial. It's going to involve a debate, but it is an interesting question about the degree that people might be willing to trade off privacy if it got greater revenues to the creation of public affairs information. And then the fourth way that I could see more stimulation about discussion about issues like climate change involves partisan information provision. The academic research on partisan information provision in the 1990s generally showed that partisan information provision was negative ads on television, which often had a demobilizing effect. The most recent academic research, some of which has been done at Yale, on partisan information provision looks at things like MoveOn and how it's able to use the Internet to mobilize and generate discussions face-to-face. And what they found, a very interesting study on MoveOn, where you had a natural experiment where half the people on one side of the road got their door knocked on by somebody who's a neighbor and they had a discussion about politics. People on the other side of the road did not get their door knocked on. The folks who got the door knock from a neighbor, voter increase participation rate by 10%, which is a huge number. So if you think about encouraging more provision of partisan information, which may change how you react to particular proposals within the realm of campaign finance law, that's another way that you could get more stimulation of discussion about climate change. So to sum up, I know your job is hard, and there are economic reasons for that. The hopeful thing to me is that if the market is not generating the type of accountability coverage, the type of public affairs coverage that you're interested in right now, we should have a debate about public policies that could affect nonprofit subsidies, because there are public policies today relating to program-related investments, or even the IRS. The IRS today has been unwilling today to say whether they would be whether they would think newspapers could operate as nonprofits. So there are a set of public policies that could be debated relating to nonprofit subsidies, relating to the creation of open source software that would enable you to do your job more easily, relating to privacy and behavioral targeting, and relating to partisan information. So I'll stop there, and I look forward to questions later on. Thank you.
Sharon Dunwoody is going to go next. I told Sharon to be spontaneous and unrehearsed, not to prepare in advance. She's also, I really appreciate her being here because I know she's on a very tight schedule. Being a local, she has a 1:30 or 2 o'clock commitment that she's got to honor. Sharon?
Hi. I'm the person at the table who's not an economist, and one need only look at my finances to get a good feel for that. But what Bud was inviting me to do is to take a look at Jim's work and his arguments and react as a journalism scholar to some of the things that he's saying. And it was a delightful assignment. I think this is a wonderful book. I brought it with me. This is his book, All the News That's Fit to Sell. Again, I would recommend it to you. It's a I think, as I mentioned to him, it strikes me as part of a little boomlet of interest in newsmaking among economists today. I'm running into a lot of econometric modeling of how news gets done, and something I hadn't seen in previous decades. Very interesting work. One article, for example, suggests that media organizations indeed have biases, but the biases are closely aligned to their audiences. And in fact, if a media organization becomes more or less biased, it begins to cut into the profits of that organization. And so it's a very interesting modeling effort to explore the nature of how news comes to be. I would note that this whole question of how news happens is of great interest not only to the practitioners but to some of us who study these processes. And I've always found it a little bit of a hard sell to make an argument to journalists that news is not entirely volitional, that in fact there are factors in the environment that encourage news to be structured in certain ways, to happen in certain ways. The kind of work that I see in Jim's book and in some of this other work is, though, quite consistent with stuff I've seen in the past that, for example, argues that media organizations are creatures of their communities. And that the way, this is a structural pluralism approach to newsmaking, and that the way power is distributed in communities actually is predictive of what newspapers will actually do. And just to give you a quick example of that, in communities where structure is highly centralized, which is to say a small number of people run the town, in that kind of a social structure, decisions are made by this small set of individuals sort of under the surface. The media organization is not needed to vet that kind of material. The media organization in that community is employed to support that power structure. So what you see in that kind of a distribution are newspapers, radio stations, television stations that are boosters. That spend a lot of their time writing about the good things in that community, not about the problems, versus communities where power is highly decentralized, which is to say there are competing power structures vying for control over a variety of issues. Though in that kind of a community, what you find is media organizations are called on to act as very central communication devices among these power structures. A power structure over here floats an idea, journalists pick it up. That message then is a central communication device to people in these other power structures. It's media organizations in these structures that are, for example, rewarded for investigative reporting. If the media organization, the newspaper in that centralized structure engages in investigative reporting, everybody clobbers it. Because that's not what it's supposed to do in that community. So I think there's a lot of interesting work out there that reflects on aspects of social structure, economic structure in this case, the distribution of power in the case of structural pluralism, that suggests that, again, media organizations as entities, as collectivities, have to fit themselves within these social structures, and that has an influence on their behavior. So I think this work is quite interesting, again, quite different, and it doesn't negate the possibility or the probability that individual journalists go out and do their individual work, but it does, I think, constrain what journalists do in any given social structure. So again, I think this is quite interesting work. Jim's and other economists make a good argument that media organizations are aligned very tightly with their audiences, and that if audiences don't want something or need something, it becomes increasingly challenging to provide it. And while that makes sense, I also think it's a fairly complex picture, and I would just end with a set of comments about that. I think that indeed most of us are information satisficers. We go through our life gathering the smallest possible pot of information in order to make a decision. We're so good at this, in fact, that we'll walk into a doctor's office, get a diagnosis of something that's rather serious, and not even seek a second opinion. In other words, we essentially make a decision on the basis of a very small amount of information. It's hard to convince us, audiences, you, me, to go into information gathering mode in a more systematic way. So I think, indeed, we're a world of fast and frugal decision makers. The question then becomes for journalists, is that dysfunctional in terms of when you and I want to write about some fairly complex stuff? I don't want to believe that's the case, and let me make a case for why I think provision of information remains valuable to audiences, even if they're not seeking it the great bulk of the time. First, with climate change, there are a lot of reasons why our audiences are not going to be active information seekers in this world. And Jim mentioned some of them, and we've got good data now that suggests that when people think of climate change, they think about things happening elsewhere. So Anthony Lieserowitz at Yale has done some very interesting work, and he asks people to share with him the first thing that comes to mind when they hear the phrase climate change or global warming. And you can imagine what those things are. Polar bears, melting glaciers, all the things that are not there, okay? And so it's really clear that again, when people aren't convinced that things matter to them personally, they are much less likely to go out seeking information. It's also clear that when they see a world that has an enormous amount of uncertainty in it, and again, it's not critical to their daily life, the default strategy is to set it aside and not pay attention to it. That isn't to say they're not worried about it, but not paying attention to it would be a very common reaction. And as Jim noted, the chances that any one of us can change the world by recycling more or putting in better windows is pretty small. And so in that sense of trying to decide what kind of an impact we have and whether it's worth it to be out seeking information about a topic like this, I can imagine that calculus is a very depressing one for someone who wants to provide information. But I think there's another side to this coin, and let me mention those. One, and Jim also mentioned this, some of us have individual commitments to particular issues. We've bought in, if not to positions on things, we bought into arguments that something's important, that something matters, and we then attend more carefully to that over time. I think there are a lot of people like that. I don't know how many of them have bought into climate change as an issue, but everybody you meet has a set of sub-issues that he or she cares deeply about and that will push her into that kind of systematic seeking and processing. So I think that, again, there are people out there with individual commitments to this kind of information. And even if you're not sure you have a commitment, if you know you're going into work the next day and it's possible that all the people at work are going to be talking about something, guess what? You bone up on it, all right? So that, again, the anticipation that you're going to be, if not challenged, at least engaged in social interactions is a very big predictor of whether or not you're going to take the time to read, to pay attention, and to learn. Last thing I want to mention is that in that great mass of people, all of us satisficers deciding today we don't have time to read that story, we don't have time to invest heavily in that topic, in that mass there's a subset of people for whom there is suddenly a need to know. A good example is in my neighborhood where this summer, we were visited by an unusual bird. I'm staring at my friend Sharon Friedman because we do a lot of birding. And into my yard came a Carolina wren who spent the summer with us. Now, Carolina wrens are pretty common to a lot of you. We're at the very, very tippy top of their northern range. They don't make it through most winters in Wisconsin, so you very rarely see them. And here was this little guy just singing all summer long in the yard. And my neighbor comes over and wants to know what this bird is. And so we start talking about Carolina wrens. She says, why is this bird here? I don't know. And I said one possibility is that we're, you know, over time, this is a more hospitable environment. And Angie is now an information seeker when it comes to climate change. This now matters to her. She wants to know more about this. And so when I talk to students about writing about complex issues, I talk about this satisficing world, but through it, up spike individuals who, for one reason or another, suddenly develop a need to know. And although the economics may not support this in the long run, I think from an ethical and a moral position, what journalists do is try to package information, not for everybody, but for those times when that spike occurs, you know, when somebody needs to know. And again, if we don't do it, nobody is going to do it. And I think it's really important to continue those practices. Thank you.
Well, I'm very happy to be here and to join everyone. And thank you, Bud, for thinking of me as part of the panel. Bud said I trained as a resource economist. That's true. I have not been a real economist in a long time, although I used to do those things. I'm sort of a quasi-economist. You know, he's not like a real Modo. He's a Quasimodo, right? That's where I am. But I haven't lost enough of it yet not to appreciate an eloquently done piece of research, which this book is, and accessible. So I do encourage everyone to read it. There's something there for everyone, whether you're in the journalism field or not. And I'm not in the journalism field at all, although I'm going to make a comment or two, maybe by way of a question or two, Jay, if you don't mind, and that'll help start off the conversation, perhaps. And I'll preface that by saying, first, I'm a newspaper guy. I come from a newspaper family. My dad was at the Washington Post for 25 years. My brother was an editorial page writer for USA Today. I still can't make the morning go without a newspaper in my hand. But I know I'm in a minority, right? And I know there aren't that many of us left. And then that goes to, and sort of realizing that, then sort of forces me to ask or pose the question that I think is the fundamental policy question that Jay's book puts out, which is sort of what is optimal? If we think we're suboptimal in some sense, what's optimal? Why do we care about a changing industry? Let's hold apart the notion of some of the product differentiations that are important and the positive externalities associated with. But, you know, I care about Detroit auto workers. I care about lots of industries. I might have cared about the whale oil industry had I been around when it was important. And I don't say this to sort of to push back on what are the changes in the industry, but rather to ask really the fundamental policy question, which is how far would we go and should we go to create a world in which we can address the dysfunctional nature of the, I forget the phrase, informational satisfiers.
Satisficers,
right? Well, who are they, right? And is there something wrong with them that they sort of don't get it, don't understand that they ought to be asking for more information when? Or is it that they have other ways of getting information, and we know people get information about news, environmental issues? We used to do, when I was at the World Resources Institute, surveys all the time. It's now dated on what sources of information about what are the sources of environmental information that people trust? Number one on the list, every survey we did was family and friends, right? It was almost always number one. The media and environmental groups sort of were tied sort of towards the top, industry way at the bottom, although I'd love to see new ones that may change given the way industries are trying to be providers of environmental information about their products, and that's an important change in the marketplace. So there are lots of places for me to get information. Why is it that we feel that sort of public affairs information, the informational externality, an important one being the case, deserves something more in the way of public attention and support, just like people argue that auto workers deserve some because there's some public benefit to having a domestic manufacturing base. So I just pose it because I think that's the interesting question that all of this gets to, and you can then begin to look at some of the policy strategies and say, well, gee, were these lower costs, or they make it easier for a consumer to consume, and how much do we want to do of those? So maybe I just leave it so we can get into Q&A with that question.
So that's a great question. In the 1980s, there was a chairman of the FCC who famously said the public interest is defined by the public's interest. And he said, his other great phrase was, TV is just a toaster with pictures. And the idea is that we don't have a toaster commission, so why do we need an FCC commission? And as of last year, there were at least two members of the FCC who believe that this externality argument that I'm making is incorrect. They don't believe that there is anything special about public affairs information. And they do have the firm belief that if the information were important, it would be created so that there's not a gap between what people need to know and what they want to know. So the FCC, I was on the phone yesterday with staff members at the FCC Econ argument office, and I was making this externalities argument, and the person stopped me and said, what's the evidence for that? What's the evidence for the argument that the information that the people in this room produces has positive spillovers beyond just entertaining, beyond just informing the individuals who are reading, that it actually impacts others? The bad news is that that's a hard question to answer econometrically for the reason of omitted variable bias. So what that means is that if you look at communities that have vibrant newspapers and really well-functioning governments, you can't make the argument that the newspapers cause the government to be vibrant. There may be underlying taste for collective action, notions of civic duty, social capital, that create both of those things. So a lot of our evidence is just correlational. The correlational evidence does show, if you look across countries, that places with more robust press have lower levels of government corruption, better outcomes in education, things like that. But controlled studies are pretty rare. The World Bank has done some interesting controlled studies where they wanted to reduce corruption in the distribution of their funds. So what they did was they took out ads in newspapers in Africa after they gave money to schools in Africa, and the ads said, guess what, your local school just got money. And that increased the amount of money that was actually spent at those local schools on the school children, because the provision of that information let people know that they were being monitored. But so if I think that it's hard to prove econometrically, what I would do is I would look at a case study. So I wrote a paper about the News and Observer, my local newspaper, and they did a story last year about parole in North Carolina. Over an eight-year period, they found that 500 people had been murdered in North Carolina by people who were out on parole, and that the parole system had done a terrible job tracking these individuals. That story cost $200,000 to produce. They told me they can only do three of those stories a year, and they have a list of similar stories that they could do. To an economist, if you think about the impact of that story, there are many people who will not read that story, who are not targets of the advertisers who supported that story, who will walk around and be alive because they won't be murdered by somebody on parole because of the legislative and policy changes that took place because of the News and Observer story. So that case study is an example of a newspaper writes a story, public policy change comes about, people are benefited by that public policy who never engaged with the media outlet. So, but I think it's a great question, in part because over the last 6 months I've seen an even more interesting thing be asserted, which is we don't need the media for democracy. Some of the most hardcore folks talking about the evolution of the internet believe that all of this can be done through networks of individuals and that we don't need an organized media. But to me, I think it's the interesting question is, what type of organizational structure is needed to support public affairs creation of stories?
Unless Roger wants a quick response to that, then we're going to go to questions. I don't think there's a mic in the room, so I'm going to ask you to stand up and identify yourself and ask your question briefly, and I'll have to repeat it for the mic. Roger?
I think that's meant to be provocative in the sense of sort of drawing out what the book makes clear in terms of sort of a difficult decision to make, and it becomes real when we have to decide to allocate public dollars or somehow to support any one of the various efforts that are there that you could use. Can you talk just a moment about what's happening sort of organically within the marketplace that's also taking up some of the slack? I mean, there is, I noted to you this column in the Wall Street Journal written by the publisher of the Wall Street Journal basically justifying why they will begin to charge for access to the Internet. In fact, I went on my iPhone this morning, tapped my Wall Street Journal app, and up comes the screen saying in 3 months I'm going to have to pay for this. But they're clearly trying to sort of create a way to capture value from those who are willing to pay it to provide a resource. And I suppose there's lots of other examples. But what are some of the organic or sort of more economically based responses that are occurring within the industry that are helping sort of meet some of the gap?
Sure. So that's a great question about the paywall. And some people, if you think about the Internet, if your information is a commodity, if it's breaking news or if it's easily created, then the price is going to get competed down to its marginal cost, which is zero. That's right. So unless you have a differentiated product, you can't charge for it. Now, what the business market will support is real-time information that helps me make an investment decision. That's the Wall Street Journal. That's product. The market that I'm most interested in is public affairs. The interesting thing there is you can charge people a lot for public affairs information if they have a producer demand for it. So CQ and Roll Call, National Journal, that's right. Yeah, so if you make money by understanding public affairs, if it's your day job, then you will pay for it. The broader citizen information, it's hard, in part because some people are enamored of the idea of the iTunes model. The big difference is that think about your favorite band. Your favorite band may not have good substitutes for it. So it's not as if you're willing to easily substitute one band for another. And your band can copyright its song. But thankfully, you can't copyright facts. It would be terrible if you could. But the fact that you can't copyright facts means that an aggregator can reposition your story, just take a little bit, and that's going to be hard. The thing that I'm most hopeful, though, is that I do believe that there could be a two-tier structure of charging if the deeper stuff that you charged for was really valuable. Okay? And so right now, a lot of the paywall discussions revolve around taking what's already created and trying to make you pay for it in a way that doesn't take into account the aggregators or substitutability. But if you had a story, and as you went deeper into the story, you could see primary source documents, you could see more transcripts, you could tap into either the producer demand or the demand of people who really value the information, they would be willing to pay for it. But that's not what the paywalls are about today.
Questions from the audience?
This is a little experiment that happened.
Please identify yourself.
I'm Frank Anthony, Wisconsin College. A little experiment this morning. I heard a speech by Al Gore. Two possible stories could be written out of that. One is the story that Frank Bayer wrote. Al Gore, former Nobel Prize laureate, congratulated President Obama, said he'll get credit eventually over time, we'll realize it's important, doing a lot of things, climate change, legislation, and whatnot. The other story is Al Gore continues to lie about global warming, says growing polar bear herd, quote, in danger. Okay. Two possible stories, 48 hours from now. If you could figure out a way to Google News, those two, which story would produce more hits? Anybody want to?
Okay. I just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially if you got the Drudge link.
Yeah. I don't know yet. Right. I'm assuming he did.
Uh-huh. So that to me, this question about product differentiation, because that's what media bias is. If you think about a model for reality, the drop in fixed cost of news outlets means that it's easier for you today to get your worldview reflected back to you. Objectivity is a commercial product that in the United States came about around 1870 with the invention of the high-speed fixed press. At that time, it became more profitable for you to stop having the word Democrat or Republican in front of your newspaper name because you wanted to get as many readers as possible so you could travel down the cost curve and spread out the cost of your press. So for a long time, we had an objective press in part because that was a great commercial product. Now, with the drop in the Internet, the fixed cost of having an outlet on the Internet is almost zero. So you're going to see more media bias in the Internet world and in the world of cable channels. And it's the more depressing thing is that the market for truth, you don't pay an individual price for having an incorrect factual idea about politics, okay? If you and what I mean by that is, if you think about the Weather Channel, there's not a rainy channel and a sunny channel, right? There's a Weather Channel, because if I want to believe that it's always raining, you know, I bear a cost for that. Or if I believed my car ran on sand, I wouldn't get around very much. So for some types of information, if I have the incorrect idea, I pay a personal price. Going back to that rational, irrational voter model, I don't really pay much of a price for believing that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11 and that we did actually find weapons of mass destruction. And there was a great study done by the University of Maryland that found for a particular cable channel, significant numbers of their viewers actually carried those two beliefs around with them. But they don't pay a price for having incorrect factual ideas. The interesting thing, too, to me about product differentiation and media bias, I can predict which outlets people in this room think are biased by the political ideology of the average consumer of that outlet and your political ideology. So people who watch Focus on the Family think that The Atlantic is biased, and people who read The Nation believe that people who read The National Review are biased. So to me, media bias is a spectrum of product differentiation, and what you think is biased depends on what your own ideology is. People will think that the media are more biased because as more media outlets are formed, you see more and more examples of people not sharing your worldview.
Yes.
Sure. So if there's a problem with covering climate change as a public affairs issue, one of the ways that reporters can bring it back into the newspaper is tapping into those other three types of demands. So if people have a consumer demand for a particular product and you can write about that, or if people have a producer demand for understanding what's going on with local businesses in their area, or if you can just make the thing personally interesting to people because it involves a neighbor or involves a local group, basically tapping into those other three demands, producer, consumer, entertainment, is a way to provide the information or the spinach that people don't like to sit still for as voters.
Other questions? Yes.
I was wondering when you
please identify.
Oh, Rebecca McLeod, student at Arizona State University. I was wondering, in your discussion of paywalls, if you were including the micropayment model. That I don't know if anybody had that yet, but if those were included in your call.
Sure. So the question about paywalls is, there have been different versions, one of which might be a subscription, or another one could be a micropayment where you would agree to pay a little bit for a little bit of information. And again, I think the micropayment, there are at least two different ways it could work. One is if the information is readily available in other ways, then it still might be hard to get a micropayment, and the transaction cost might be hard. However, if you tap into people's altruism or identity, sometimes you see this on particular sites, and I think the nonprofit sites that are growing, Voice of San Diego, MenPost, and even listeners like you, National Public Radio. I mean, the idea is that we're not giving for the tote bag, although we all got great tote bags this morning. But we're not giving for that. I think it's more about identity consumption. It's expression. And so I think that some people will give, not if you say, give me a nickel because you read this, but if you create an identity about public affairs consumption, this is something that you should support as a citizen. I think that's going to be an interesting area of research. There's a Chicago economist named John List who's been doing very interesting experiments, basically on the economics of fundraising and charities. So I think it's an interesting idea that Voice of San Diego and other people, ProPublica, are going to have to face, which is, what sort of identity can you tap into to get individuals to give you money to support your journalism? That's great. So the question is, I talked a little bit about partisan information provision, and could journalists tap into it? I viewed it more as a partial substitute for the type of discussion that journalists generate. On the order of people are depressed that public affairs coverage and mainstream media outlets is going down, but if there's another source of information that may try to provide you with some type of information. And when I say partisan information, I'm not talking Fox News. You know, I am talking about either environmental groups or parties or politicians who might try to provide you with some information with face-to-face discussion. But that's an area of research that I'm engaged in right now, trying to look at the type of information that you get from partisan discussion or partisan provision versus the type of information that you get in particular types of journalistic outlets.
I'd like to ask a question of Roger. Roger, several times... No, but several times during the conference, I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but several times during the conference we've heard about nonprofits and nonprofit journalism and foundation-supported journalism. Do you and your peers see a future in which funding independent, responsible, investigative journalism is something that the charitable community might look at and move into?
No fair, bud. Well, I certainly can't speak for my colleagues, and it's not an area of specific interest or programmatic interest to the Johnson Foundation. But let me then, sort of saying that, let's just speak more generally. I think one of the powerful parts of Jay's book is it begins to create the basis for going to foundations and beginning to have the conversation about why talking about it. High-end used hard news versus soft news, and maybe that's a tough thing to make some distinction from. But let's say high-end news reporting or public affairs reporting is something that requires a public support, right? And I think, you know, we just haven't had that out there. Now, there's no foundation funding environmental groups in this country that doesn't require somewhere along the line as part of their grant making a communication plan. How are you going to work with the press? How are you going to work with the media? And we think about it a lot in our own programming. How do we most effectively work with media, and how do we do it ourselves? Should we blog? Should we do all of those things are sort of part and parcel of what we consider. So one good question is sort of, it would be going and beginning to talk to foundations about the inability of some of the other programmatic areas that they are very deeply supportive of, the problem that are arising in terms of moving those agendas when you have the media structure going the way it is. And that's just an argument that I don't believe have been made and could be, and Jay's book says they should be.
I've actually found two instances where I've got foundations who are interested in giving to subsidize reporting in a commercial newspaper, and the editor backed away. Mm-hmm. And because they said, well, we cover that person. That was number one. Or what would that do if it wouldn't it seem like we were taking a side? But that's an interesting discussion that I hope that more newspaper editors will have, because it's a question of whether transparent coverage is better, that's funded by a nonprofit, is better than no coverage. Because in both those instances, I said, so you are willing to tell me you will not tell the story to your readers because you won't take that money? And he said, yeah.
That's not uncommon, not surprising. I think we have like maybe 5 minutes left, so if we could take at least maybe a couple more questions, please. Thanks, Brad.
158. Can I follow up on that?
Yeah.
Jay, are there any implications of that that one ought to be thinking about in terms of the economic model? I mean, does that lead to sort of inherent biases, potential for inherent biases? Or?
Well, when I think of information, there has to be incentive to create it. It could be, I want you to pay me for it, that's subscription. I want to sell your eyeballs to advertisers, that's our advertising model. I want to get your vote, that's partisan information. I want to change what you're thinking about, that's nonprofit foundation incentive. So to me, all information has an incentive behind its creation and wants to change a decision. You just need to be more transparent about it. I totally agree with everything Brand has said. I think that an interesting question is, a lot of the nonprofits like ProPublica and others are successful in part because they have the echo of partnering with a commercial partner. And I'm worried, but I don't want to give up on the newspapers because I want to try to maintain these large distribution outlets for the nonprofits to infiltrate.
Mm-hmm. Take one last question.
Thank you.
That's, and I, one of those, part of it is developing an excludable good, something that people have to pay for. So that's training, that's conferences. It could be special research, which what Global Post is proposing to do. There's a great book by Hal Varian and Carl Shapiro called Information Rules that Hal Varian wrote before he became Google's chief economist. And it goes through and lists for you the different ways that you can make money by giving your information away for free and then creating an excludable good.
We're going to close with the final question, final word from Dan. Dan, from.
This is more of a plug than
a. Never mind then.
I did want to make a point that this is sort of half of the discussion, is that as Glenn and I will be able to continue the conversation.
Thank you, Dan, and thank you to the panel also.